Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Now, our next guest breaks down major economic theories and problems like unemployment and inflation for the layman. His new book demystifies macroeconomics. He's a columnist at the Financial Times. The book is called The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy. Tim Harford, welcome to WNYC.
Thanks very much.
And you've written about microeconomics in the past, but this new book is about macroeconomics. So just in case some of our listeners who never got to take Econ 101 are curious, can you explain the difference between the two to start out?
Yeah, sure. I prefer PJ O'Rourke's definition of the difference. So microeconomists are economists who are wrong about specific things, whereas macroeconomists are economists who are wrong about things in general. The general idea is microeconomics is the stuff the decisions we make every day. You go into Starbucks, they've got different prices. They're trying to get you to spend money in different ways. The decisions of consumers, the decisions of corporations. Macroeconomics is the stuff that we think about as economics: unemployment, inflation, recessions, stimulus. And we know it's important. The financial crisis taught us the hard way that it's important. But I think that we think of it quite rightly as being very political, very polemical, and hard to understand. And the idea of the new book was to make it less political, less polemical, and kind of fun. Because actually, deep down, it is really interesting. It's just most people aren't interested in finding the interesting parts. They're just interested in making a political point.
So listeners, anything you've always wanted to ask about macroeconomics but didn't have anybody in your living room, 212-433 WNYC. Anything you've always wanted to ask an undercover economist, 212-433-9692. And I'll dive right into one. One of the most basic and puzzling problems in economics, and one that's in the headlines right now, too, that you write about: unemployment. Benefits are running out across the United States for people who have been unemployed a certain amount of time. And this federal extension of jobless benefits is stuck in Congress. And you write about how Henry Ford invented unemployment. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, I didn't mean it entirely seriously, but there was a serious point. So Ford came up with this amazing and controversial and I think now famous innovation that he just overnight tripled wages for his workers. And he didn't do that because he had designs on being a philanthropist at the time. It was a business decision. And the problem he was dealing with was that actually auto workers in Detroit at the time were operating in a textbook perfect market. So you could walk out of a job anywhere and walk into an identical job paying the same money anywhere else. If you wanted to take a holiday, you wouldn't apply for vacation. You'd just walk out and not come back. And what that meant was there was no loyalty. The auto companies were spending a lot on training. There was a tremendous amount of staff turnover. And if workers were upset with something a supervisor had said, they would literally throw the proverbial spanner in the works and gum up the production line. And so Ford's tripling of wages changed all of that. It made a job at the Ford factory a real prize. So men would queue around the block in Detroit in January, being hosed down by the police. And you can think about how quickly your clothes are going to turn to ice. They just sort of go home, get changed, and come back out and queue around the block to try to get a job at the Ford plant. So Ford was making money because people really wanted these jobs and they really valued them. And once they had them, they were loyal, they worked hard, they didn't just take time off without leave. But then think about the wider economy. Suddenly, unemployment is baked in to the Detroit economy because Ford is paying more than the market rate. There are people outside the factory who want a job with Ford, and there are people inside the factory really counting their lucky stars. They've got a job with Ford. They're happy. Ford's happy. But the economy as a whole is not necessarily working well. And that's something we find in the modern world. There's a big queue for jobs, but employers won't cut wages and expand the market of people who are working. They'd rather just keep the few loyal workers they have.
So it's really the history of the dawn of the industrial era and the kind of job market that it created, I guess, is what you're giving us there. And so take us one step into how to solve the unemployment that industrial economies create and now post-industrial economies exacerbate. I think you can disagree with that if you want. But there are different approaches to addressing structural unemployment. And you say it's not totally clear to you which one is better. And you contrast the U.S. and Germany, which have different approaches to dealing with unemployment. So I found that really interesting. Why don't you talk about that?
Yeah, there's this a bit of a myth. So the idea is the U.S. has super flexible labor markets and people can get fired with no notice. And what that means is they can get hired again quickly because employers know, well, they can always fire them again. So that means that the economy contracts quickly in a recession, but it expands quickly in a boom. You know, employers aren't afraid of taking on someone and then not being able to get rid of them. And that's true. The myth is that in Europe, there's just this totally different setup where it's much harder to hire somebody. The truth is that some European countries are like that. So Spain, for instance, you have this labor market where once you've hired somebody, it's almost impossible to sack them. You are paying them months and months and months of severance pay for every year that they've worked. And so this is this permanent permanent commitment to an employee, which sounds nice. But what that means is just it's impossible to get a job in Spain. I mean, youth unemployment is around 50%. Can you imagine 50%? It's incredible. So half of the people, young people out there trying to get jobs, can't get them in Spain. Now, Germany has a different system to Spain. So Germany has created a sort of, it's more of a marriage than this sort of the speed dating of the US employment system. So there's a relationship between workers and management. There are unions. Unions are quite strong. So there's this long-term commitment, but at the same time, there is flexibility. There's a lot of flexibility over wages. German wages have come down relative to other European wages over the last 10 years or so. So they seem to have found a system that works. The American system has also worked a lot better than most European countries. So I know it doesn't seem like it's working well at the moment, but nothing seems like it's working well at the moment because the recession's been so long-lasting. Well, those are two systems that seem to have sort of bright elements in them. But, you know, we mustn't forget, you can actually learn a lot about even the little details of what's going on. So in the UK, my own country, the government recently decided to run a little experiment about what happens in the offices where you go to collect your unemployment benefit and you're supposed to be given some job counselling. And they took this office just east of London and they said, right, there's a first floor, there's a second floor. People will be randomly assigned to the first floor or the second floor. And on the second floor, we have our new system. On the first floor, we have our old system. And the old system was all about basically making sure you weren't cheating. So making sure that in the last 2 weeks, you were looking for a job, you were available for a job, otherwise you don't deserve your benefit payment. The second floor, the top floor, it was much more forward-looking. So they were giving people real advice. They were helping people design their resumes. They were getting them to fill in a time use diaries. Not what did you do last week, but what are you going to do next week? What jobs are you going to apply for? And because this was a randomized trial, there's no politics in it. You could just find out which of these two systems worked better. And it turns out the top floor, the second floor, the forward-looking floor, was much more effective than the kind of punishment floor, the first floor. So
are
you can run these little experiments.
Implications from that for large policy decisions?
Well, I think so, because when you take one of those decisions and you scale it up across an entire country, this is going to make a real difference to how quickly people find jobs. The message there is, yeah, some people are scroungers. Some people are just trying to collect money from the state and they don't want a job. But that's not most people. Most people are looking for a job, but they may not have the skills to find one. They may be out of practice. They may be perfectly well qualified to work, but just not well qualified to write a resume. And the government can actually, it turns out, provide some help. And ultimately, we're not interested in punishing people for being unemployed. We just want people to have a job so we don't have to, you know, they can work, they can pay taxes, and we don't have to pay unemployment benefits anymore. So, but, you know, one of the messages there is we all have our ideological views about what should work and what shouldn't work,
right.
It's always worth just going out and testing them. If you can run an experiment, you can find out what works, and then you should do it.
Let's get a couple of callers in for you. John in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Tim Harford, the undercover economist.
Hi. On the news, whenever there's any talk of population, say in Europe or any of the kind of advanced economies, quote unquote, we hear that it's awful that Italy has a slow birth rate, or that it, you know, there's a danger in Japan in that they're not producing enough people. And it seems like there's the premise is that in a modern economy, you always need to have a growing population. To grow the economy, the population needs to grow. I know that's in part to pay for pensions, but it seems like just the economic growth rate is predicated on population growth. And that seems, from an environmental standpoint, not a very sustainable system or model on which to base an economy. Is that, in a macroeconomic theory, do we need to continue to have growing population?
It's a great question. And I would add, Tim, that I hear alarm bells in the media on kind of both sides of this equation. Certainly, oh, my God, we have shrinking populations and aging populations in Italy and Japan, and as he said, and to some degree the United States, though to a lesser degree. At the same time, I feel like when we hear about turmoil in places like Egypt, it's like, and they have 40% of their population under 21. Oh, my goodness. You know, so how do you pick all that apart and understand what's the threat?
I totally agree with – was that John?
Yes.
Was that called? John, I totally agree with John's – where John's coming from here.
The environmental concern, right?
The environmental concerns are very serious. You know, ultimately, there are only so many people the planet can sustain. Fortunately, you're absolutely right. Population growth has slowed down. So in the 70s, we thought that the population of the world was going to be 12, 13 billion by now. It slowed way down and is stabilizing. So that just leaves us with this question of pensions and the demographics. And it's absolutely true that it causes a problem in the short term. But I think that our institutions should be able to adapt. I mean, fundamentally, people are living longer, and that's good news. I mean, why would that not be good news, that you expected people to die at the age of, I think 64 was the life expectancy when Bismarck first introduced a pension in Germany, and the pension paid out at 65, so you were expected to die before you got the state pension. Now we're expected to live well into our 80s, and yet the pension age hasn't moved. You know, we can adapt. I'm sure we can cope with it, but there are these political rigidities and make it hard to adapt. So I don't think this is fundamentally about the economics. I think this is about the politics. You've got senior citizens. They've got benefits that are being given to them by the state, and they vote, and there are a lot of them, and they don't want those benefits to be taken away. And why would they? I wouldn't want my benefits taken away. And so they defend those benefits, whether it's healthcare, whether it's pensions, whatever it is. But I feel confident we will, in the end, be able to adapt to these pressures. It puts an economy under strain, but it's not essential.
Let's take one more, and then we're going to be out of time for today. Walter in Monmouth, you're on WNYC. Hello. Walter, you there? One more question. Walter, turn your radio down. You're hearing us on delay. Our guest, Tim Harford, author of The Undercover Economist, Strikes Back. He's a Financial Times columnist. And then after this call, we're going to go on to how to protect you and your stuff from the cold. But, Walter, are you there?
Yes.
Hi.
Yes, I'm here.
Turn your radio off and what's your question?
Okay. My question is that in the past, we've been basically an industrial economy, so that things like education and unions help to drive our wages up with the skills that we learned and what we produced. Now, since we've shifted to a service economy, education doesn't help us in any way in improving our status in a service economy. So wages have been coming down, plus unions have been going down. So that kind of shift has basically brought our middle class down to where it is right now.
And I wonder if you would concur with that theory, Tim, and this will be our last answer, and we'll have you back and talk about some more macroeconomics and demystify some more. But honestly, I tend to think of it kind of the opposite from Walter, which is that in today's post-industrial economy, education matters more than ever, because you could go out with just a high school education and get a job in one of Henry Ford's factories and have it be decent and put you in, you know, at least a decent level of working class America, middle class. And now there's so much bifurcation in the economy that unless you are highly educated and can join certain aspects of the professional class, you're kind of more screwed than you used to be.
I agree, Brian. I think education is more important than ever. But I think Walter has a very important point, which is there is a lot of pressure that's been put on middle-class jobs. Even when the economy was growing, median incomes, that's the income of the person basically in the middle of the population, they weren't growing for a long time. This was particularly an American phenomenon. So there is a concern. And, of course, it's all very well to say everyone needs to go out and get a college-level education, but some people just aren't suited to that. Some people don't have, you know, they have other interests, they have different skill sets, and in the old industrial economy, there was an outlet for that.
Right, and it's a matter of mass numbers, right? Because when this comes up on the show, people will call in and say, but the world still needs plumbers and all those people, and don't discount them. And, of course, you wouldn't discount them, but in terms of numbers in a mass economy, it doesn't add up as it did in the past.
Here's the fact you need to know. Manufacturing employment in China is falling. It's been falling for years. If it's falling in China, how on earth do we think we can keep it up in Europe or America? So the world is changing. Just one ray of hope. I mean, I am concerned about these trends, but we've had this terrible recession, really dreadful recession. Historically, when you look back, people are constantly mistaking the short term for the long term. We've had 5 years, 6 years of bad news, and I think a lot of people now feel, well, things will never be better. The economy is structurally damaged, and that's it. It's game over. And I don't believe that. I think we've had a terrible shock. I think it's had a terrible human cost. And I think there are long-term issues to solve. But ultimately, I'm an optimist. And I think technological progress and human ingenuity is going to put the economy back on track, and we will get there in the end. So let's not be permanent pessimists simply because we've had this really terrible crisis, because all crises in the end come to an end.
Let's hear it for the optimists, especially optimists with actual solutions. Tim Harford, author of The Undercover Economist Strikes Back, How to Run or Ruin an Economy. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And up next, how to protect yourself and your stuff from the cold.